It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about some of the zany new food on a stick we'll see at this year's Wisconsin State Fair.
And some old favorites, too, like the cream puff.
But first, we're talking to a former prisoner who spent 12 years in different kinds of solitary confinement. His story, three consecutive all-white, all-male juries found Wilbert Rideau guilty of murder for the death of a teller during a bank robbery.
In 2005, a mixed-race jury acquitted Rideau of murder and found him guilty of manslaughter. He was sentenced to 21 years in prison, and since he'd already served 44 years during the appeals process, he was immediately freed.
He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times last week in response to the tens of thousands of California prisoners who went on a hunger strike to protest prison conditions. That strike started on July 8th.
He's here to tell us his thoughts on the prison protests now. Wilbert Rideau, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Veronica.
Can you tell me what went through your mind when you first heard about the hunger strike among these California prisoners?
Well, most people were just looking at the fact that, hey, these guys are on hunger strike and, you know, it's not much of a big deal. But the fact is, number one, the size of it is simply amazing. It's unprecedented that, you know, you're talking about two-thirds of the state's facilities, over 30,000 prisoners. We've never had prison protests of that magnitude in the history of this country. And the other thing that I know, having been a prisoner, I realized that for that to happen, you have to understand, you know, while popular perception is that prisoners sit around plotting and scheming to make trouble for the authorities because they're bored to death and have nothing better to do, or because they hate them. And that's fiction. That's something that's promoted by prison managers and movie makers. The truth of the matter is that a prison protest is extremely difficult to pull off in prison, not to even mention the size of this one. And that's because the established order in prison, the inmate power structure, works against prison protests, and they work to prevent it. Nobody wants a prison protest because even the innocent in prison are punished if they just close to a prison protest have nothing to do with it. The innocent is punished as well as guilty. So, you know, the typical guy doesn't want trouble. He just wants to serve his time and stay away from that.
Okay, so given that, can you give us a sense about what it would take for prisoners, and a huge percentage of them, like you just said, what it would take for them to decide to make a gesture like this?
Things would have to get so bad that they feel that, understand, they're dealing with, in prison, you're dealing with absolute power, and because that's what authorities have, and pulling off a hunger strike or any type of protest in prison is much the same as armed conflict in Syria or a hunger strike in Guantanamo. You're spitting in the eye of absolute power. That's declaring war. And you're always going to come out on the losing end. The thing is that authority will have to have pushed the line of tolerance so much until they just feel compelled to do something. I mean, the prisoners just feel that they're sort of desperate because they feel they have no more options to resolve their grievances, whatever their grievances are. When they feel that authority has abused their powers and they have no options, well, that's when you get a protest. But you got to push them pretty much against the wall.
Now, this protest is largely about the overuse of solitary confinement, according to these inmates who are on hunger strike right now. And you have served yourself 12 years in solitary confinement. You served longer than that. 12 of them were solitary. But what would you say about that aspect of it, the solitary confinement being so objectionable that this is what the prisoners decided to do?
Well, solitary confinement, taking a person and isolating them for years in a cell, and understand, it's about the size of the typical bathroom. That's the cruelest thing you will ever do to another human being. I mean, think about having to stay in your bathroom for one weekend or 1 week, let alone 30 years, like Tommy Silverstein has stayed in the federal supermax prison cell over in Colorado, or Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace has spent over 40 years in a cell here in Louisiana. You know, think about where were you 40 years ago, and just think back from that time, and you'll realize just how long that person has been sitting in that one little box, totally divorced from everything else. And, you know, when you do something to somebody like that, what you're doing is, I doubt if you take, the typical person doesn't, they pretty much take it for granted. You know, all the small everyday interactions that you get, you know, with neighbors, with coworkers, with taxi drivers or waitresses. You know, all these people give you feedback every day that reinforce your sense of who you are and your place in the world. And until you suffer such deprivations, you don't realize just how important that is, because once, when you deprive human contact and that type of social interaction and all that external stimulation, you lose the context for your being, you know, for who you are. And then you start to deteriorate. And over a certain amount of time, you're going to lose your connection to the world that you once knew.
Now, I suppose that the people in charge of keeping this prison running, they might say that solitary confinement is a necessary tool that they've got to keep order and to lower violence. What would you say to that?
Well, they do say that. In fact, they've got an excuse for everything they do. You know, they've got a rationale for everything they do. And understand, if they're doing all that, why are they having a hunger strike? If everything is hunky-dory and peaceful in the place, everything is right, and the prison administration is doing right, why do you have a problem? Why? What are they protesting for? You know, it only happens when people get desperate. And I don't think when you keep somebody locked up in a cell for 40 years, you're not talking about controlling violence. You're not talking, I mean, this is ludicrous. I mean, you're talking about an entire lifetime. And usually a lot of these guys haven't done anything. From what I understand, over in California, a lot of them are because of who they believe they associate with. You know, whether they're associated with gang members or, you know, it's an allegation. And the only way you get out of solitary confinement is you have to snitch on somebody else and tell them that, hey, look, so-and-so, you know, this other guy's a member of a gang. Well, can you imagine the amount of lying that's going on or fabrication just to get out?
Now, you've actually spent 12 of the years you served in solitary confinement. Since then, you've gone on and you wrote an op-ed about this prison strike in the New York Times. You have been an NPR correspondent. You work on documentaries and as an editor. But I wonder, even with all that under your belt now, do you still think back on solitary confinement and has it changed you?
Veronica, solitary confinement, let me tell you this. The other thing you did mention is I wrote a memoir in the place of justice, and I was told to write a sample chapter. I wrote about solitary, and that sold the book. Yes, I think about it. You don't ever lose that. I mean, I probably can, unlike a lot of people, it didn't break me. And, you know, because like I often tell people, you know, you're always hearing about guys, you know, broken and destroyed by that. Yes, I saw guys commit suicide. I saw guys who were crushed by the experience and ended up just empty shells of what once contained a human being. But that didn't happen to me. You know, it's all in what you take into that cell with you, who and what you are. And, you know, I guess it's kind of like a religious experience. Some people are improved by it, and others are crushed completely. But, yes, I think about it. I think about Not only that, but the entire prison experience. It's part of who I am. You don't spend 44 years in the military or in any other place, and it's not part of you.
Well, Wilbert, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Wilbert Rideau, a lecturer, capital defense consultant, and the author of that book you just mentioned, In the Place of Justice, A Story of Punishment and Deliverance.
Coming up next, we'll talk about some new foods we can expect to see at the Wisconsin State Fair this year. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We talk about issues in the news and topics that improve the quality of our lives.
Wait a second. I thought I lived in a democracy. I thought that I had rights, but most of those rights, or many of them, have been taken away from us, or we voluntarily have handed them over.
I want these kids off of my lawn, and I want it to stop sleeting and snowing. Those are the only two things that I ask right now.
Add your voice to the mix of lively guests with different perspectives.
The Joy Cardine Show, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, University Bookstore, and the Oneida Tribe of Indians of Wisconsin. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor.
Wisconsin Public Radio is everywhere. On the radio, online, on demand, on your smartphone, on the way to work, on your mind. Go to wpr.org and turn it on.
Tomorrow morning on the Joy Cardine Show, starting at 6 a.m., Joy and her guests talk about tipping. Used to be a courtesy in restaurants, now it's become almost mandatory. Joy's guest says there are a lot of good reasons to get rid of the tipping system altogether. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 6 on the Joy Cardine Show.
And Kristen Durst joins us now from the newsroom with a look at headlines. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin State Fair opens August 1st, and while there's definitely a lot to do, and even if you don't indulge in a single hot dog on a stick, the occasional indulgence of State Fair food is a Wisconsin tradition.
Here to tell us about this year's new offerings is Kathleen O'Leary. She's the Director of Marketing Communications for the Wisconsin State Fair. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Now, I hear there are over 70 new menu items on this year's list. What are you most excited about?
You know what? There's so many that are so intriguing that it's really kind of awe-inspiring, if you will. I love potatoes, being a good Irish girl. So I'm very interested in the garlic-buttered new potatoes on a stick. So not one of the more crazy out there ones like the brown sugar bacon-wrapped hot dog on a stick, but that one kind of stood out. So that's definitely one that I'm going to go try at Joey's Tempura stand.
Yeah, that one you could eat, and then you could have a cream puff afterwards and maybe not feel too bad. Potatoes on a stick, that's, you know, it's a vegetable of sorts.
There you go.
Suspiciously healthy. I don't know.
Well, actually, you know what? When you come to the Wisconsin State Fair, there are no fat grams, there's no guilt, there's no calories. It's all about just coming and having a wonderful time and grazing your way through.
So there's, something like 21 menu items that are prepared on a stick. What's the deal with food on a stick at the State Fair?
You know what? I believe it's really the fair industry as a whole, and it all stems back. I mean, again, we're so steeped into tradition and history. I mean, this is our 162nd Wisconsin State Fair, and it's just, you know, it starts with the corn dogs, the cotton candy, the caramel apples. You know, so you really think about those traditional items, and now there they all are on that stick. So as our vendors and as just, you know, the consumer in general becomes a little more innovative and a little more edgy, that's where some of these new, crazy, creative ideas, and it also stems from when you think of the fair, you think of the what we call in the industry the pitchmen, the people that are out there with the sham wows and the salsa makers. So you kind of get those little more quirky, crazy things. So I think they took it from there, and then they decided to, like, put it to the food side. So now we have everything from, you know, again, back to that brown sugar bacon-wrapped hot dog on a stick to, you know, this new hot pretzel with bacon and chocolate sauce on a stick.
Do you get a sense that these vendors are getting a sense of pride in coming up with the wildest, wackiest thing that gets everybody's attention?
Well, here is, and it's just such a perfect segue into something that, yes, to answer your question without a doubt, they really, really try and break themselves out of the clutter. And we've watched it now over the course of the years just get more exciting and more out there. So we, this year, for the first year, created a food competition. And we challenged our food vendors to come up with really exciting, novel ideas that you wouldn't ever think of, and they had to all be new, and they couldn't have that been anything that had been on their menu or any other menu for that fact. So we had 42 of our vendors come up with all different ideas. We narrowed it down. We actually created a panel, a judging panel. We narrowed it down from the 42 entries down to 8. So now these 8 finalists will all come together on July 30th. We will have celebrity judges to come out on the 30th, and we will judge and come up with what we're calling the Sporkies. When you come to the fair, it's a stick. Is it a spoon? Do you need a fork? Do you need a fork and a knife? So now it's the Sporkies. So it will be the Sporkies Award, and this is like showing an animal for our youth in our great state that they vie for that blue ribbon. These vendors are vying for this Sporky Award. And when you come out to the fair, which opens in 9 days, you'll be able to see all of the 42 finalists will be showcasing the item that they entered, and then the 8 finalists will also be showcased with a different type of indication. It's like a little flag that you won't be able to miss, and then certainly the Sporky winner will also not only be announced in the media, but will also have some other way to really showcase that that was the winner of the 2013 Sporky Award.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on the winner of that one.
And here, I'll just share with you quickly, the Thanksgiving waffle is a finalist. Island Slaw, which is from our island noodle vendors.
Now, wait, what is a Thanksgiving waffle? I got to know.
It's got some stuffing in it. It's got some turkeys in it. It's got some cranberry. It's all those great things that you come to love over Thanksgiving.
On a waffle.
All in a waffle.
Gotcha.
The
Rochester Shrimp
Slider is in there. Mac Attack is in there. The Melafrida Gelato on a Stick is in there. Iced Irish Coffee Float is in there. And the deep-fried peanut butter and bacon nuggets with Barry Weiss jelly. And then the 8th one is the Cajun mac and cheese.
Oh, I'd eat that. That sounds it's not on a stick, though, right?
That one is not on a stick.
Wow. So those are some adventures in Wisconsin eating for you right there. I have to ask you about another one that's on the list of the 70 new items, the Krispy Kreme burger with spicy pig candy. What is that?
And I wish that I could answer that question for you, but it's going to be bacon-related.
Bacon-related.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it's a burger on a donut.
It is the burger. The Krispy Kreme is the bun, and the spicy pig candy will be bacon with a coating that has a bit of a spice to it.
Wow.
Do you think
it's crispy.
Do you think the food itself is part of why some people go? I mean, you know, yes, there's all the animals. Yes, there's the rides on the Midway. But are people doing some food tourism there, and that's why they're at the fair?
You know what? There's no question that it's one of the mainstays. And when we do our surveys or, you know, we hear consumer feedback in a variety of different ways that we gather that data, yes, food is really right up there with entertainment. And then certainly, you know, being the agricultural showcase, there's no question that, you know, seeing the animals in the barns and having that be part of your experience are the top three, you know, experiences that people are looking forward to all year long at the Wisconsin State Fair.
What's kind of nice about it is it's not highbrow. This is egalitarian food. It just tastes good. It's probably, let's be honest, it's probably not that good for you, but it's fun to try things and see what you like and see what these creative cooks are coming up with.
You know what? It really is. It's something different. You know, we all love to do our routine type of things, but when you come to the Wisconsin State Fair, it's really the last bastion of Americana. Is that a great way to say it? In the sense that this is what we are all about. It's about the family network, the idea of gathering together, whether it's the gathering of family or the gathering of friends and family, but people are coming out to be entertained. And the beauty of the fair industry, but the Wisconsin State Fair in particular, is it's very individualistic. Even just the three of us right here, I mean, we certainly have all of our listeners hearing this, but, you know, your idea, Veronica, is very much different probably for what you're going to be looking forward to than mine, and likewise. But everybody gets something. Everybody gets to have a takeaway when they come here. And you can spend, you know, 2 hours or 8 hours. And certainly people come multiple days because you just can't do it all because there's so much.
I'm guessing Rob might like the deep fried taco cheesecake.
That might be a little intense for
no.
me.
No, but there were some, okay, what some... about the Cajun frog legs on a stick?
I would try that.
And we're getting healthier.
Yeah, protein.
Protein.
And Cajun, that's an interesting twist.
It's in their tropics, that's Joey's Seafood, excuse me. Joey does a great job with his coconut shrimp and all of those, so that's going to be an interesting one. And certainly frog legs on a stick, frog legs in general, but then on a stick, you know, again, where else would you? And it goes back to what I said earlier about where else would you walk away with a salsa maker and a ladder that extends, you know, 75 feet. You didn't even know you needed it. You quite frankly didn't even know it existed. And then the next thing you know, you're sitting next to somebody you didn't even know, but now you're buying the two for one, and you're leaving with a ladder, a blue mop, and a salsa maker.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and it's so wonderful. We're going to open up the gates in 9 days, and we're so excited because it's not our state fair, it's your state fair. And it's something that you really should come out to. If you haven't, please do, because this is really the celebration of everything we should be so proud of in Wisconsin.
Kathleen O'Leary, I'm going to jump in here. Kathleen O'Leary is the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Wisconsin State Fair that opens August 1st.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at President Obama's major address on the economy. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. The United States declared war on cancer in 1971. 4 decades later, 1.5 million Americans are diagnosed yearly with over 600 deaths. It kills more children than any other disease. In his new book, journalist Clifton Leaf argues that we should have come a lot closer to an all-out cure by now and that the current system for curing cancer is failing us. Leaf is a survivor of cancer himself, and his new book is The Truth in Small Doses, Why We Are Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. Clifton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Well, I want to start with how you end your book. You talk about a survey done in 1949. Americans asked if they thought man would walk on the moon if rockets could reach the moon in 50 years. Most of us said no. When asked if we would cure cancer in the next 50 years, 88% said yes. Why were we so optimistic? And, of course, we'll spend the most of the hour talking about this. Why were we so wrong?
Well, I think we're optimistic because we have this sense that science, and in those days, particularly American science, could do anything. There was this great can-do Buck Rogers attitude that, you know, if we just put enough money into research dollars, we'd be able to solve any imaginable problem. And I actually don't think that the answer even then was that we would find cures for cancer or any specific single cure, but rather, you know, if we could make great gains in sort of increasing lifespan and reducing the burden of cancer. And I think that still is the goal rather than a single overarching cure.
Well, what kind of resources have we dedicated to fighting cancer since we started this war on it in 1971?
Well, one of the challenges of sort of calculating how much we spend is that, you know, the actual federal allotment to the National Cancer Institute is actually only a small portion of what we really spend. You have to figure in the private research dollars, the citizen-raised research dollars through cancer charities, the state funds, and et cetera. And then when you add on all the treatment dollars, it just becomes a staggering figure because some of that money is in turn recycled into, you know, drug R&D. So it's you know, hundreds of billions of dollars on this problem. And part of what I look at in the book is how we spend that money, whether more money, you know, the central argument has always been, well, just give us more money to solve this issue. And I think, in general, I'd rather have more money going to cancer research than, say, you know, military research. But that said, the way we spend this money actually, you know, doesn't open that many new research doors. It's kind of shocking how that happens.
So over 600,000 deaths a year, 1.5 million Americans diagnosed. I mean, are we seeing some kind of improvement for all the money we've put into it?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. If you look at the rate that most researchers like to look at, it's called the age-adjusted death rate or age-adjusted incidence rate. So what that does is it filters out the sort of growing the size of the nation, but also its age distribution. So the fact that we're getting older, it filters that out. So if you compare the nation to where it was in 1970, that age-adjusted death rate has gone down. But the crude death rate, which is just a simple, you know, bit of addition, it's, you know, how many people are getting it per the number of people in the country, that number has gone up about 14% since 1970. And the fact is that we're getting older. You know, we're getting older as a nation. We're growing. And those, you can't filter that out of the cancer burden. You know, we have to take care of people as they age, too.
Now, the heart of your book is making the case that there are fundamental flaws in the way we tackle and manage, as you mentioned, our cancer research and our cancer spending. What were some of the mistaken assumptions that were made when the war on cancer started in 1971?
Well, I think there are three different areas. The first is one, I talked a little bit about this sort of straightforwardness of what the cancer burden really looked like. And so, and I can come back to that in depth in a minute, but just the general idea is it's not just the number of people dying of cancer that's important, but also the number of people getting cancer. It's a very grueling disease to treat. Some people think of the treatment as almost as, you know, as horrible as the disease itself in some cases. And so, we had to look at, well, how many people were getting this disease? And that number has risen three times faster than the rise of population since 1970. So that's an extraordinary aspect of the burden, and I think we have to be straightforward about it. We also, I think, have a failure of strategy. We just come at this disease with weight. You know, a lot of, if we look at all the progress we've made against heart disease and stroke and all the other killers of old age, you know, we have gotten into those diseases. We've intervened much, much earlier in the developmental process. And the third issue is really about systems. We just don't have any systems that allow researchers to share their data, share their specimens, share, you know, the fast-changing knowledge that happens in this business.
That survey I mentioned at the outset compared, you know, the race for the moon with the research, the effort to cure cancer.
Yeah.
You say that the race for the moon was managed as a big engineering problem. The war on cancer wasn't. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, when we look back at the moonshot, we think of this sort of glorious, perfect, you know, scientific movement. You know, it was just this, you know, we had the science, we learned everything we needed to learn to send the man to the moon and back. But in fact, it was a great big engineering project, and it failed in the beginning. In the beginning, there was a program called Ranger, and it was one colossal failure after the next with each launch. And when, you know, when those who were in charge investigated the issue, they realized, well, it was kind of treated like a science project with JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where all these geniuses were kind of focused on their own little aspect of the problem, and no one was kind of knew, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And so they went back to this, and they said, listen, the secret here is management. We've got to make sure people are talking to each other. We've got to make sure systems are compatible. We've got to make sure that we have a common goal. And that's what I mean by an engineering challenge. You know, we're able to do all these extraordinary projects in life, and, you know, that really have defined the great 21st and 20th century of American know-how. And yet, when we treat this as simply a science problem where everybody is left to their own lights, it's just too much to manage. And so that's where I feel like we need to refocus this as an envision this as an engineering challenge.
So what would that look like? I mean, right now we've got all these different funded research facilities around the country, each doing their own thing. How would you how do you muster that together and get them all pointed in the same direction?
Well, the first thing we could do is just simply get some standards. You know, we don't actually have standards for, say, common reagents in cancer research. We don't have standards when you're measuring a certain protein on a cancer cell. We don't actually have a standard for measuring that. So somebody who's measuring the HER2 protein, which is a telltale protein for certain breast cancers, we have a different way of measuring that depending on who measures it. And that's just crazy. There are things called microarrays, which are these, you know, very essential tools of doing molecular of analysis on cancer tissue. And different microarrays use different technology so that the readings from one aren't necessarily compatible with the readings from another. So the first thing we could do is just pretty simple. We could just get common standards. And there are all sorts of aspects of tissue sharing. I mean, one of the fundamental questions that I had when I started was people would talk about this sort of lack of tissue, cancer tissue, you know. Every time you a new patient, and you mentioned, you know, 1.7 million Americans are newly diagnosed with a cancer each year. Every time they get a blood test or a biopsy, that's a piece of cancer tissue, and that's used for research. And yet people would tell me what a shortage there was. Well, the reason is because there's no network for sharing that. It's a valuable resource that would really help researchers of all stripes and all places, you know, learn a little bit more about this, what's causing various cancers, and yet there's a shortage of this tumor specimens because no one knows how to share them.
You also critique the oncology profession, the research profession, for being not willing to take big risks. They'll pick away at the margins and improve that mortality rate by a month or two here and there, but they're not going to go long and shoot for the big, different way of thinking. Why is that?
You know, it's just sort of built into what I call the cancer culture. And it's a very risk-averse culture. And it's sort of shocking when you think about science because you think of this sort of Norman Rockwell image of a scientist in the lab coat, you know, taking these sort of big stands against convention. And that's really not what most modern science looks like, at least in terms of cancer research. There is a, you know, in the grants-giving process, there is something called the study section, which is the sort of peer group that evaluates each grant. And there's a saying that the study section won't approve of a grant unless it already knows the answer to the question that's being asked. And this is sort of well-known. So a lot of the, you know, scientists, the blue ribbon panels of scientists that have looked at this have said, listen, we're just so risk-averse. We've got to change. But the culture perpetuates this sort of teeny, teeny incremental gains in knowledge. And on the drug development side, on the treatment side, that also, that deadly caution is there as well.
Talking to Clifton Leaf about his new book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. I know we have some cancer researchers who listen to the Ideas Network sometimes. Are you out there? What do you think about what you're hearing? Do you agree? Are you nodding your head or do you not buy it? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you have thoughts or questions about the war on cancer, 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking to Clifton Leaf about his new book, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to the phones, Clifton, you made a splash with an article about this almost a decade ago now. You started this discussion of how we might be losing the war on cancer. What has the response been from the cancer research community? Did you tick them off, or are they agreeing with you in large measure?
You know, I would have assumed that I would tick them off, certainly when I wrote the piece a long time ago. But, you know, instead of getting too much of a blowback, I really got an invitation. I got a, you know, some researchers were very, very sophisticated about, you know, talking about sort of breaking down the problems as I diagnosed them. And they'd say, listen, you got, you know, one thing you got absolutely wrong, it just drives me insane, but then you got all these other things right. And then we talk about them, and, you know, and then somebody else would say the same thing, except they would say the thing that the first person I got wrong, you know, that was the right one and the other was the wrong. But I got just invited to talk everywhere and have these very long, sprawling conversations with people. And that's really what encouraged me to go off and write the book. I didn't think it would take, you know, 9 years, but that was certainly one of the bright spots of that endeavor.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Pete on the line in La Crosse. Pete, thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi, Doyle. Hi, Dr. Lee. In the last 30 years or so, the healthcare community has been pushing a low-fat diet, which basically gives a free pass to sugar and carbohydrates. And some researchers see a connection between these high sugar levels and the insulin that goes with that and higher cancer levels. I'm just wondering if the guest sees that connection as well. And if so, you know, would that be countering a lot of our gains in terms of defeating cancer? Thanks.
Clifton Leaf, I don't know if you looked at that specifically, but talk about it if you have. But in general, we can get into cancer prevention, too.
Sure. I mean, I think that's a fantastic question. I mean, and it drives to one of the sort of cultural imperatives of cancer in the last couple of decades, which is to see this disease as really a genetically driven disease. And it is. Cancer is, in fact, driven by genetic aberrations. It starts with when one, you know, mutation or alteration in the cell comes and gives that cell a certain survival advantage, and it sort of cascades into a viable tumor if all these other things go wrong. But yet there are so many other aspects of the cancer process that are really above and beyond the genomic changes. And so one of those is metabolic. And there has been, you know, ever since Otto Warburg started talking about this in the 1920s and 30s, it was clear that there were metabolic changes in the cancer cell that, which may, in fact, be fed by things in our lifestyle or diet or other factors, that are really instrumental to the cancer process. But yet those kinds of ideas haven't gotten the kind of exploration money, the funding that sort of pure gene jockeys have gotten. And so that's part of that cancer culture. You know, there's been a lot now, there's sort of a resurgence in this idea called metabolomics. But for years, many of the people who were studying this were toiling in obscurity.
So funding-wise, we're more willing to say, hey, you're doing research that's slightly different from that last research we funded. Great, here's some money. But you're doing research that's really different from what everybody else is doing. The purse strings are a little tighter.
Yeah, a lot tighter. And so there are areas, when I first started writing about this, there was an area called epigenetics, which is just really the changes that happen outside, beyond the sort of genetic deletions or mutations or other aberrations. This is sort of what's happening that to affect gene expression, for example, which may be, you know, not related to a specific mutation. And epigenetics was one of these critically important ideas, it turns out, that just wasn't getting funded. And so, again, people would talk about this sort of, well, are you going to, you know, hit it right down the mainstream or not? And if you're not, then, you know, well, you better get lucky and find some funding somewhere else.
Thanks a lot for the call, Pete. Now we have Matthew with us in Spring Green. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how you doing? And thanks, Clifton, for writing your book. My wife had pancreatic cancer, and she was diagnosed in December of 2007. She was stage 4A. She was given 3 months to live. You were just talking about, you know, diet stuff. That's what we did. We changed her diet. She's alive. She's cancer-free. She's had complications, you know, because the tumor cut off the portal vein, and, you know, it was around the portal vein and the hepatic artery, and she had splenic vein trouble. But, you know, we beat it. They're studying what we did at the UW, or, you know, part of what we did. Part of it is, I think, you know, people don't swing for the fences. I think they're tentative. I think we were told that multiple times. You know, they couldn't do this or couldn't do that. And I think, you know, I don't know. You know, sometimes I get confused as to why they don't just go for it. But
gotcha. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Matthew. They don't swing for the fences in his and his wife's experience. And you talk about there's a thin line between risk-taking and recklessness. And I think you're advocating, Clifton, that we should go closer to the line of recklessness. Is that right?
Yeah, I am. It seems like a crazy thing to say. First, I want to thank Matthew for the call. And just, you know, this is one of those stories that you people do well, and thank God they do. My mother, you know, she was diagnosed with a rare cancer called carcinoid syndrome and given about 6 months to live many, many, many years ago. And she lived, you know, 27 years with that cancer. So, you know, we just simply don't know a lot of why things work and why they don't. I think diet and lifestyle probably plays a major role. But there have got to be other factors at the individual level. And, you know, the idea that people are so remarkably different from each other in their physiology, in their genome, in everything that we can imagine, there's this variability. And so we have to figure out better ways to learn from why people are responding and doing better and why they're not. So this idea of swinging for the fences is I think, a really critical one. I mean, I write about, you know, one of our great victories in the war on cancer, which is against over childhood cancers. And in that case, it really was a very thin line between revelation and recklessness, between true dynamic exploration and doing something that today Sidney Farber, who is the father of pediatric cancers, would be arrested for. So it really is one of those things that I think we need to learn from our past a lot more about what works.
Wayne emails, there's the perception that cancer is a single disease. It isn't. There are probably as many causes of different kinds of cancers as there are for all other diseases together. He says that's one of the biggest obstacles in fighting cancer. Is that is he on target there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's completely right. You know, I mean, we talked about sub-diseases of cancer, and he's talking about, you know, hundreds of subtypes of cancer that are sometimes they are broken down or increasingly broken down by molecular subtypes. So we might, for example, talk about a HER2-positive breast cancer or HER2-negative breast cancer as one subtype of cancer. But, you know, there are also there are also differences in the sort of cancer cell type. So, you know, you'd have, you know, luminal breast cancers or inflammatory breast cancers, and so that would be different as well. And so that is the challenge, is that each of these subtypes of disease seem to act like a different disease when we treat them in a common way. So the response to that is, well, then we have to change our clinical trials process, and we have to change our funding process to match that heterogeneity of diseases. Right now, when we do these big box clinical trials, we're throwing one drug at lots of different types of cancer all in a pile, and we don't really know what works and what doesn't. So he's absolutely right that is one of the sort of, you know, pathological problems, and it's also one of our organizational problems.
Just a minute or so left. The last words of your title is How to Win It, it being the war on cancer. If you can make one change in the way we deal with cancer, what would it be? What's the big thing we could do?
Well, I think I would start with being straightforward about what the burden is. You know, we have to think about the fact that when we started this, you know, we are three times more people getting cancer, more than twice as many dying from it each year. What we're doing isn't working. And so when you look at that and you're honest about that, then you have to look for ways to fix it. And there are ways. We just have to be first honest that there's a genuine problem.
And are you optimistic that we can win the war on cancer?
I'm phenomenally optimistic, actually. I really, from spending all this time talking with people, I in the hallways, spoken to more than 1,000 people over time, some of them formal interviews, but many more just conversations, I'm convinced that people in the community, in the research community, want to change badly, and they're willing to do what it takes to get there.
Clifton, thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. Great conversation.
That's Clifton Leaf. He's the author of The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It.
And our Geek Out segment is next. This time we'll look at the appeal of Renaissance fairs. That's coming up after the news. I'm Veronica Rickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.